Already? Okay. Thank you. Marshall, if you can call a court to order, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Bradfold, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
Thank you. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, October 6th, 2021. We have six cases on our calendar today, four of which are set for oral argument. This is the first one. This is case number A21-0459, All Incorporated versus Christopher Hagen. Counsel for both parties, this is being recorded. No other recording is permitted. Other than that, all other rules of court apply to this. We will be having 15 minutes for arguments by appellant, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes by appellant if you want to for rebuttal. There is a timer that you should be able to see that will indicate how much time that you have. Please pay attention to that so you know how much time is left before your time does expire. We are holding this by zoom.gov. If there are any technical issues at all, we'll certainly make sure that we accommodate anything. Technology is great, but it's not perfect. And on occasion, we do have and have run into technical issues, and we'll make sure that we address those if and when they do occur. Just wanted to double check again. Counsel for appellant, could you just say something to make sure that we can hear you clearly?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm counsel for appellant.
Okay. Thank you. Counsel for respondent, same.
Yes, Your Honor. Counsel for respondent.
Okay. Sounds good. With that, counsel for appellant, please state your name for the record and the party you're representing, and you may begin your oral arguments.
May it please the court. My name is Neil Polstein, and I represent All Inc., a local supplier of cabinets and appliances, and we are the appellant in this appeal. And if I may begin, Your Honor, with the Ryan case, Ryan versus O'Neill, which is one of the cases that Mr. Hagen cites as part of his list pendants argument, the Minnesota Supreme Court said, and I quote, section 514.03 governs the extent and the amount of a mechanics lien. And that has been our position from the get-go. We said over and over again that 514.03 is the relevant statute for the court to examine to determine the amount of my client's lien, including when it's zero. And it's the only relevant statute for that purpose. And Mr. Hagen has disagreed. He argues that a subcontractor's right to assert a lien may depend on how well and how much the contractor performed the other parts of the general contract. And where the contractor has, for whatever reason, failed to complete all of the other parts of the contract, a subcontractor has no lien if the owner has already made partial payments in excess of what the contractor has earned for his partial performance. He bases that position solely on the wording of the notice that Minnesota Statute Section 514.011 requires subcontractors to give in most situations involving residential construction. In particular, he focuses on the language in the notice that says a subcontractor can assert a lien if the owner has already paid the contract, quote, in full, unquote. And I believe the central question that the court is called upon to address in this appeal is what does 514.011 mean when it refers to payment, quote, unquote, in full? Does it mean, as we contend, pay the full stated contract price? Or does it mean, as Mr. Hagen contends, paying the contractor what he has earned through partial performance of a contract that he's only partially completed? And there are many reasons why we believe Mr. Hagen's position is untenable. And if I may, I'd like to focus the bulk of my time on those problems and what I consider the top six. First, Your Honors, consider the nature of Minnesota Statute Section 514.011. It's a notice statute. Its only apparent purpose is to state when notice must be given to a homeowner and what that notice must say. Yet Mr. Hagen's position assumes that it serves an additional purpose and a surprising purpose, that the legislature intended to make this notice statute, the repository and the expression of a new rule, a new defense, a defense existing only by reason of the verbiage of 514.01 and referred to or mentioned or alluded to nowhere else in the mechanics lien chapter. We submit, first of all, that it would be an odd thing for the legislature to have intended to create this substantive defense merely by having a notice be worded a certain way. It's not impossible because the legislature obviously can do what the legislature wants, but it's so unusual that it's reasonable right off the bat to doubt that there was any such legislative intent.
Council, can I reframe your argument just for a moment? It strikes me that your claim is that 514.03, the extent and amount of the lien, sets forth the substantive basis for a mechanics lien, right?
Well, the amount of the lien, yes. There are other provisions.
Yes. And then 514.011 sets forth the procedure by which the lien can be perfected. Is that right?
It includes a notice requirement, yes.
Okay. Go ahead, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Secondly, Your Honor, we submit that it would be doubly odd for the legislature to have selected the notice statute as the repository and expression of this new defense when the mechanics lien statute has another section covering the same subject matter, a section whose sole purpose is to set forth the rules and a formula for determining the amount of a subcontractor's lien, including when it's reduced to zero. A formula which expressly takes into account payments made to the contractor and says what the effect is of such payments on the lien amount, including when such payments are sufficient on their own to reduce the lien amount to zero. And it's a formula which expressly refers repeatedly to Minnesota Statute Section 514.11, but nowhere alludes to the existence of this new defense based upon partial payments arising under the notice statute. And I refer, of course, to Section 514.03. The formula is that found in Subdivision 2C, and the reference to treatment and significance of payments made to the contractor is found in Subdivision 2C, Roman numeral I. The references to Minnesota Statute 514.011 is found throughout 514.03.
Mr. Polstein, would you walk us through how this portion of the statute you're referring to right now, so subdivision 2C, how that would work in this case?
Well, you start with the stated contract price. The statute allows for the possibility of additional amounts, but there are no additional amounts in this case. And starting with the contract stated price of $82,000 in this case, there are three types of allowable deducts, one of which is payments made to the contractor before receipt of the pre-lien notice. So if the contractor has received payments that equal to the stated contract price, the lien is going to be zero. There are two other types of deductions.
My question is geared toward the specific facts in this case. So obviously there is a deduction to be made from the contract price here on because Mr. Hagen did make some payments prior to being served with the lien notice. So what is that amount?
$70,000 in change.
Right. And you filed a lien for what, about $7,600?
$7,250.
Okay. That's it, thanks, go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Thirdly, it would be triply odd, if I can use that word, for the legislature to have intended 514.01 to create this new defense, given that the legislature covered the same subject matter in 514.03 in the same legislative session, in the same bill in which it enacted 514.011. So the cap formula in 514.03 and 514.011 are sister statutes, so to speak. And you have to believe that was the legislature's intent to create a set of rules for reducing a subcontractor's lien below the reasonable value of its services, even to the point of zero, and include all those rules in 514.03(2C), while saving just one extra one for the notice statute, it said. And that makes no sense, Your Honor. Fourth reason, given the common origin and the overlapping subject matter, the doctrine of in pari materia applies. And it says that 514.011 should be read to the extent possible so as to be harmonious and consistent with the cap formula in 514.03. The cap formula is very clear and unambiguous in identifying the amount of payments to the contractor that can by themselves suffice to reduce the lien to zero, and that amounts to the full stated contract price. So it's reasonable, therefore, to view 514.011 as referring to the same amount of payments needed for that purpose under the cap formula when it speaks of payment in full. To put it another way, under the in pari materia doctrine, the court should regard 514.01's quote in full language not as an independent standalone rule existing only by reason of the verbiage found in the notice statute, but rather as a paraphrase of a substantive rule created elsewhere, that elsewhere being the cap formula of 514.03. And this idea that 514.011 should be viewed as merely reflecting rules found elsewhere in the statute is consistent with what the other rules stated in the notice language. The notice language doesn't speak only of payment in full. The language appearing right before the pager in your contractor in full sentence informs the owner that it has the right to pay us directly and deduct this amount from the contract price or withhold the amount due us from your contractor. I won't read the whole passage, but where does this come from? It comes right out of section 514.07. So here in the sentence before the paid in full sentence, the notice is merely paraphrasing another part of the lien chapter. And so similarly, the notice should be seen as merely paraphrasing 514.032C Romanet I when it says the lien is zero if the contractor is paid in full. And note, Your Honor, when we're on the subject, that the payments described in 514.03 have a timing element. In order to reduce the lien amount even to zero, they have to precede the arrival of the pre-lien notice. And the same thing is true of the payments referenced in 514.01, when it says if you paid your contractor in full before receiving this notice. So that's further evidence that both statutes are talking about the same thing, the same bushel of payments sufficient to reduce the subcontractor's claim down to zero. The fifth reason has to do with the purpose of giving notice to homeowners. The purpose of a notice is to impart information that's understandable by the recipient so that he can then use or apply that information in deciding what to do going forward. If, as we say, paid in full means paid the full contract price, then the sentence in which the phrase appears is straightforward and can be readily understood by any homeowner. But according to Mr. Hagen, the phrase in full, although it might mean payment in full of stated contract price, also has a hidden meaning. It's really a legal term of art, meaning something different than payment of the full contract price. If you have a certain set of circumstances, which as counsel described at the summary judgment hearing is very narrow, and they include there must be a breach, the breach must be material, the contractor must at some point, even months later, admit that he's been paid in full, the contractor must have failed to reach substantial completion, and the owner must have paid the contractor an amount in excess of the, quote, reasonable value, unquote, of the contractor's work is actually performed. But the notice language doesn't inform the owner of any of these predicate conditions. And even if it did, the average homeowner wouldn't know what to do with that information, wouldn't know how to assess and apply these sundry requirements. The homeowners don't know what substantial completion means. They don't know how to determine the reasonable value of the contractor's work. In many cases, the average homeowner won't even know whether there's been a breach, especially considering that most contracts, as well as the contractor warranty statute, have a notice, an opportunity to cure requirement, which they'd have to navigate. So the notice is pointless if the information contained in the statute is incomprehensible. And it would be incomprehensible if the notice even bothered to inform the homeowner of all these little particulars, which it doesn't in the first place.
Mr. Paulson?
Yes, sir.
To that point, isn't the result that you are proposing of interpreting the section 514.03 as really the substantive portion that relates to the procedural portion? Doesn't that really end up in a harsh result for a homeowner in this case?
It may, but the choice is a harsh result for the subcontractor or the homeowner. Yes, there are situations where there might be double payment, but someone's going to lose. And the law has been generally solicitous of the interests of the subcontractor.
Or the homeowner, even though...
But there also is also an opportunity for the subcontractor to lose. If the payments happen to reach the contract amount, then the subcontractor is out of luck. So, you know, it goes either way. But I hope that answers your question.
Yes, thank you.
So, Mr. Polstein, would you please follow up, though, with Judge Reyes's question and explain whether there's a harsh result in this case if we adopt your interpretation of the statutes?
I don't necessarily know because I don't know the facts of this case. This is the other part of our argument that the factual record is so obscure and lacking information, it's hard to say what happened. But we have an 82,000.
Well, let me just pause for a minute. I guess I understood it's undisputed that the cabinets were provided, installed, satisfactory, and that your client has not been paid.
True.
Okay. And I understand that there are some difficulties that relate to Mr. Hagen. I'm sure we'll hear more about them. And I'm sympathetic to those difficulties. But at least as to your client, it seems to me that you're looking to be paid for work that was actually done, performed satisfactorily.
Yes, and I don't think it's unfair because in this case, according to Mr. Hagen, he had made up his mind not to pay anybody after February 14th, and he allowed my client to come in and install these cabinets without any intention of ever paying the contractor or my client. And he's getting the benefit of our work. This is a classic subcontractor situation. The homeowner is getting the benefit of what we did. And I don't think it's unfair that our lien should not be dependent upon what the contractor did. Whether the contractor completed the contract, didn't complete the contract, owes money, that shouldn't affect, and historically has never affected, the amount of the subcontractor's right to be paid for what the subcontractor has done. And I see I've run out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Polstein. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes. And as soon as we get up on the clock, there we go. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Courtney Ernston, and I represent the respondent in this matter, Christopher Hagen. Before I begin my argument, I would like to briefly touch on Mr. Polstein's last statement that he just made to the court, that my client, Christopher Hagen, allowed his client to enter his home and put in these cabinets with no intention of paying them and no intention of making any further payments. That could not be further from the truth. What happened was Fair and Square Remodeling already received the money from my client for those cabinets. So Fair and Square Remodeling had that money to pay All Inc. for the cabinets that were received. Fair and Square chose not to make those payments because of poor business decisions that Fair and Square made. So the statement that my client allowed All Inc. to enter the home and install these cabinets with no intention of paying, that's incorrect. My client had paid for those cabinets already, and it was his understanding that the work was going to continue to proceed until such time that the payments that he had made matched the amount of work that Fair and Square had provided. Unfortunately, I apologize.
Counsel, just if I can interrupt briefly, it seems to me that that position that you're explaining now, that the payments had been made to Fair and Square, is at least supported in, if not fully, at least in part, by the confession of judgment. That
correct.
Isn't that right? Okay. Thank
absolutely.
You.
And so the fact that the last payment occurred in February, it was never Mr. Hagen's intention to allow individuals not to be paid. Mr. Hagen was under the understanding that all of these individuals were going to be paid. It was unfortunately found out that Fair and Square and Mr. Otto, the owner of Fair and Square, turned out to be extremely dishonest individuals and stole money from a number of homeowners, including Mr. Hagen. So I just wanted to address that point briefly. Turning to my argument, Your Honors, I'd like to talk, Mr. Polstein spent most of his time talking about what he believed the legislator's intent was. In this instance, Your Honors, we have a case that's directly on point, and it goes entirely against Mr. Polstein's argument. Now, I apologize because I typically don't like to read verbatim from cases. However, in this particular instance, Your Honors, the language of this case is so incredibly on point that I think it is appropriate for me to read this.
Well, Ms. Ernston, before you go there, I suspect you're going to be reading from the ECI case, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's a 1976 case that came out prior to the changes in the statutes that are at issue here. So I think it might be, your time might be better spent by focusing on the particular statute. And in particular, I thought Judge Frisch laid it out fairly well in terms of 514.03 looks like that is really the substantive portion of the statute, whereas 514.011 has a procedure. In other words, it has the notice, a format of what type of notice should be provided. And I note that under 514.03, it not once, but twice actually refers to the notice that's required under 514.011, both in the initial part of subdivision two and also in subdivision two sub C I. Can you talk about 514.03 and explain why that does not apply in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. So to your statement regarding ECI, I would like to point out to Your Honor that this court in 2005 cited to ECI stating that if a contractor does not substantially perform, an enforceable contract does not exist, and the lien amount is based on the reasonable value of the completed work. So, Your Honor, I would say that I actually respectfully disagree with your statement that ECI is not applicable in this case, because this court cited to the decision in ECI, which is exactly the case that we have here, that that Fair and Square did not substantially perform under the contract. And therefore, we go back to this quantum merit argument that is contained in the ECI case. And so, Your Honor, while I understand that 514.03 has these requirements and 2C lays out what the subcontractor can do, I would state that we don't get to that point in this case because Fair and Square failed to even remotely substantially complete the project. Therefore, as this court cited in Standard Plumbing Appliance v. Gadke, that there is no enforceable contract here. And that is further affirmed by the—
How are you defining substantial completion of the contract?
Your Honor, the substantial completion is defined as— I apologize if you can just give me one second here.
I mean, when I look at the confession, it says there was a partial performance, but not everything was done. Fair and Square partially performed the work. Fair and Square did not perform all of the work for which Hagen paid Fair and Square. I don't see anything in the confession, and I don't recall anything in the record that would denote whether there was substantial completion. I mean, it does indicate that $70,000 worth of work was performed out of an $80,000 contract.
Correct, Your Honor.
And so what's the threshold there?
So substantial completion is when all the necessary elements to the contract have been completed, except for some, quote, slight and unintentional defects, which can be readily remedied, or for which an allowance covering the cost of remedying the same can be made from the contract price. Here we have—
What's the record that we have about substantial completion?
Well, Your Honor, we have an $82,000 contract, and we have a confession of judgment stating that the contractor owes Mr. Hagen more than the original contract, because not only did Fair and Square fail to complete the work, much of the work that they did complete had to be redone because it was improperly done. Therefore, there is absolutely no way under any facts or any circumstances that any reasonable fact finder could find that was substantial performance, the fact that the contractor owes the homeowner more money than the contract, there can be no reasonable inference that substantial completion was anywhere near what would have been achieved had there been some sort of an argument made. Furthermore, All Inc. failed to provide any evidence, which was noted by the district court, that there was not substantial, or that there was substantial completion here. So All Inc. did not provide any sort of rebuttal to this confession of judgment, stating that Fair and Square owed Mr. Hagen $90,000+. So, Your Honor, and Judge Reyes, I would like to maybe re-ask if my response to your question was sufficient, or if you would like me to go further into the statute.
Actually, I would like you to go back to, it's my question. I don't think you answered. I think you answered Judge Frisch's question. I did want to make one comment. You do refer to the case that cites to ECI, but that's one that was a 2005 decision too. That's a non-precedential decision. So that's not binding on this court. But I would like you to go back to 514.03, because as I mentioned earlier, that does explicitly reference 514.011. And that seems to be the substantive statute that applies in this case, and in particular to the contract price, and not whether or not there was substantial completion of the contract.
Yes, Your Honor. And while I agree with what you're saying in terms of the actual words of the statute, I would urge this court to adopt the language in the non-precedential opinion of the Standard Plumbing case, because I believe that that case states that 514.03 is reserved for situations whereby the contract is substantially completed. And so, Your Honor, I would posit that I don't think we get to 514.03 because we have in this situation a contractor that took advantage of a homeowner, and therefore there is no enforceable contract, so to speak, as it relates to the language found in ECI and then further cited in the Standard Plumbing case. And so
I'm having a hard time following that argument. I understand your argument in your brief, but you'd never in the brief directly address that, whether the applicability of 514.03. It explicitly refers to section 514.011. How is it that we cannot, how can we just ignore 514.03?
It's not that we're ignoring 514.03, Your Honor. It's that 514.03 applies in situations where there is a defined scope of work, an agreed upon scope of work, and the work has been completed. And so in this particular case, the reason we don't get there, applying the facts to this case, is because the final payment made by Mr. Hagen was made prior to the notice being given by All Inc. So the All Inc. pre-lien notice came after the final payment was made. And so this is not a case where we have a homeowner that's attempting to, you know, as the appellant suggests, attempting to not pay a subcontractor or to skirt anything. We have a homeowner that has made his final payment in February to the contractor. The contractor admits that that was the final payment. Appellant even admits that that was the final payment. And therefore, we don't get to the notice because that final payment was already made.
And so, are you relying on the language in 514.011 for that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, but that's not a standalone provision. That all that is that all 514.011 does is provide, and the language I assume you're referring to is that in the notice that has to be provided where it says, we may not, quote, we may not file a lien if you paid your contractor in full before receiving this notice. Is that the language you're relying on?
Correct, Your Honor.
And that's a language that the district court did as well. But the district court never referenced, referred to, or cited to 514.03. How can you rely on that? That's just part of the notice that the person needs to provide. That says nothing about what that means. It provides nothing in terms of the substance, the substantive law that is underlying it.
Yes, I agree with the premise, the basic premise that 514 is the vehicle in which to provide the notice. However, our position is that we don't get to 514.03 because we have that language that bars any sort of a mathematical calculation because the payment has been made.
But that 514.011 cannot stand alone. That's just the procedure. That's not the binding statute of what needs to be done. We need to look at something else. What do we look at? Do we look at 514.03? Do we look at 514.01? It seems to be that 514.03 is the statute that was overlooked because that it talks about the extent and amount of the lien and specifically talks about the notice required and specifically refers to 514.011. Maybe another way of rephrasing my question is, what in 514.03 and in particular subdivision 2, which refers to notice required, what portion of that subdivision supports your argument that it supports your position? What in there would support your position in 514.03 subdivision 2?
514.03 subdivision 2 C1, Your Honor, states that that the sum of all liens shall be calculated by payments, it's the work that was done less the total of 1, payments made by the owner to the owner's agent to the contractor prior to receiving any notice under 514.011. And the notice that was received under 514.011 was received after the final payment was made. So to answer your question directly, Your Honor, it's 514.03 sub 2 C1.
What about the contract price? Because it does refer to contract price. And I know that's something that appellants argued and that actually refers back to the antecedent basis in subdivision 2A of the contract with the owner and for an agreed price. So in other words, that is the price that's been agreed to. And that's what we look at. We don't look at whether or not there has been substantial compliance with the contract prior to the notice being received.
And Your Honor, to that, I would go back and I still stand by my statement there that this court's non-precedential opinion in the Standard Plumbing case finds that there is no agreed upon contract price when there was no substantial completion. So I believe that this court should adopt that language. And I see that I'm out of time, if I may briefly finish answering your question, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
I believe that case is what this court should find in determining that there was no substantial completion. Therefore, we don't get to 2A in determining that there was a final contract price because this court found that is not no longer a contract when we have the breach.
Judge Risch, did you have a question?
I have a follow-up question, if I may, yes. Judge Reyes. Counsel, how do you account for the inclusion of the word said before contract price in subdivision 2C in 514.03? I mean, it seems to me that your arguments about substantial completion are addressed by the legislature's inclusion of said before our contract price. And there's only one contract here.
Correct, Your Honor, and I believe that this court made it clear in the Standard Plumbing case that we only get to said contract, meaning the agreed upon contract price, when there is substantial completion. And so because we didn't get there, there is no said contract price because this court found that an enforceable contract does not exist.
And I just have one follow-up question. Since I'm presiding, I will give myself permission to ask that. And just to be clear, you're relying on case law. You're not relying on any language in 514.03 of substantial completion.
Correct, Your Honor, because that case was decided in 2005 and it's 2021 and the legislature has not done anything to rectify the decision that was made. So therefore, yes, Your Honor, I do believe that that is the appropriate remedy in this case.
Okay, thank you. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And I believe you're on mute. There you go.
Yes, I have to unmute. I've never really understood the significance to a respondent of ECI, but if she's arguing that we don't get to apply 514.03 because there wasn't a contract or there was one initially, but there wasn't one at the end, then my response is that's a dead end argument because 514.03 2C is the only thing in the statute that would serve to reduce the amount of the lien from an amount to make it lower than the reasonable value of the services provided. That formula may not apply in a given instance, but where it applies, it only helps the homeowner. So you take that out of the equation. There's no precedent, there's no history in the mechanics lien law for limiting a mechanics subcontractor's lien based upon anything other than that formula, where it applies. So remove it. You know, that's fine with me because it doesn't hurt me. Ms. Ernston has said repeatedly that there is no substantial completion. And in response to Judge Frisch's question, and the record is clear on that, and the record consists of the confession of judgment. And I have been very critical about the confession of judgment, and I wish to be critical still. I think if you read the confession of judgment, it's essentially informationless. It's free, information free, that is. You don't know when a breach occurred. You don't know what the breach consisted of. You don't know whether there were any damages. You don't know what the value, the reasonable value was of the work performed because you don't identify what the work performed was. You don't know the additional cost incurred. It says Hagen incurred additional costs through the failure to complete the project, but you don't know when, how much, or for what. Ms. Ernston said work had to be redone, and that's why the amount is so great. There's nothing in the record to support that. There's nothing in the confession that says any work had to be redone. You know, maybe it happened, maybe it didn't. I don't know, but I do know that the confession of judgment doesn't tell you these things. The only thing that the confession of judgment does is creates an impression. It has a spectacular number of $94,000 as an amount owing by the contractor, not to the contractor. So you assume something terrible must have happened. You know, maybe the roof fell in or he set fire to the apartment. Or maybe this has to do with attorney's fees, which is what Ms. Ernston hinted at in her brief. And attorney's fees aren't even legally recoverable in this case. But the fact is, we don't know what the $94,000 consists of. We don't really know anything about the underlying facts in this case because the confession of judgment doesn't provide the information, nor does Mr. Hagen's affidavit. And that's the only thing that the record consists of. You've got the confession, you've got the affidavit, the contract itself, and nothing else. I mean, that's the record. As to whether or not Mr. Hagen was trying to cheat us or not cheat us, I was just responding to Judge Reyes's question about whether it's unfair or unfortunate. It doesn't matter to me what his intention was. In fact, the record doesn't show that he was intent on February 14th not to make another payment. I don't know when he made up his mind. The record doesn't disclose that, but it doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter to me whether he had a good intent or bad intent. What matters to me is under the statute, I'm a subcontractor and I'm entitled to be paid unless there's something in the statute that says I don't get the reasonable value of my services. And the only thing that could be is 514.03, and it doesn't do that in this case. And that's all I have to say in rebuttal, Your Honor.
Your Honor, I have one brief point of misclassification of the fact. It's not in response to Mr. Hagen, if I may. If not, that's fine.
I'm not sure I quite follow you, Counsel, but what did you want to clarify?
It was simply relating to when 514-03 was promulgated by the Minnesota legislature, and it was in 1971, which was prior to the ECI case in 1975. And I just wanted to make that one point of clarification.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments and your briefing, both very well done. We appreciate that. We'll be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. That case is now submitted. Thank you both.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors.